This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
On The Briefing Room today, we'll be asking a simple question about any possible end to the war in Ukraine. There are talks in Saudi Arabia, talks in Europe, a stalled proposal for a full ceasefire, proposals for limited ceasefires in limited areas. All of it made more complex by an absence of trust between almost everybody involved. But in the end, any substantial peace will depend on one thing. Vladimir Putin started this war. What will be his bottom line for ending it? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's trace the evolution of the Russian leader's attitude towards Ukraine. Vitaly Shevchenko is Russia editor for BBC Monitoring and co-presenter of the BBC's Ukraine cast. Vitaly Shevchenko, what do we know about how Vladimir Putin first began to think about Ukraine?
I think there never was a time when he wasn't thinking about Ukraine, because for Vladimir Putin, and I have to say for a significant part of Russian society, it doesn't seem as though they have genuinely accepted Ukraine as a sovereign state that is free to make its own sovereign decisions. So what Vladimir Putin is doing now, I tend to see it as a manifestation of a wider problem that is rooted in distant past, centuries of Russian rule in Ukraine. Ukraine, or parts of Ukraine, used to be part of the Russian Empire. To come back to Vladimir Putin specifically, time and again, for years, he referred to Russians and Ukrainians as one people. Immediately before the start of his so-called special military operation, he wrote an article about the historical unity of the Russian and Ukrainian peoples. The implication being that Ukraine doesn't really have its own identity, language, history, culture, it's part of Russia. And thinking back to my own experience growing up in the Soviet Union, there was this feeling of Russia being the bigger brother. That's a phrase that was mentioned a lot. And Ukraine and the other Soviet socialist republics were junior brothers. So there was a slightly condescending attitude.
And you lived in Ukraine?
I did, yes, for most of my life. And that's why when Vladimir Putin started sounding increasingly more aggressive towards Ukraine in the run-up to the initial invasion, which Russia denied carrying out in 2014, it didn't really come as a surprise because Russia wanted to keep Ukraine as its own. There was a time when he was seemingly happy with the idea of Ukraine existing as an independent state. He kept saying, no, Ukraine's Ukraine, Russia's Russia, we're fine with it. But that lasted as long as Ukraine's leaders acted as though Ukraine was firmly in Russia's orbit. The moment that changed, Russia simply turned off the gas. And I remember the cold, dark winters when there's no heating, no gas, and it was a grim time. So that is something that's really difficult to see as something else rather than a punishment for Ukraine looking elsewhere.
So essentially Putin's attitude evolved from one of toleration as long as Ukraine was essentially a client state into one of aggression once Ukraine sought active independence and separate sovereignty. And that
presumably is what led him to annex the Crimea in 2014 and to undertake operations in eastern Ukraine.
I think so. Ukraine and Russia are linked historically, culturally, linguistically. And for Vladimir Putin and his supporters, this means that Ukraine has to belong to Russia. Take Belarus, another Slavonic state that is firmly in Russia's orbit. Formally, it's independent, it's got its own leader, but it's also part of the so-called Union State of Russia and Belarus. And for Vladimir Putin, this is what he wants. You can be sort of formally independent, but you belong to us.
And when that stopped happening, that's when he decided to take military action back in 2014. So then there's a gap, and then you get the full-scale invasion. Going back to just before the full-scale invasion, there were plenty of warnings that it might be about to happen. Do you recall what the reaction of the West was when they realised that maybe there was going to be this invasion?
There were other events that led up to it that tested Western resolve and Western response. Georgia in 2008, Moldova before that. Those Russian, I wouldn't call them invasions in Moldova's case, but Russian involvement there, it also amounts to meddling in the affairs of those countries. And Western response wasn't sufficient to make Vladimir Putin change his behavior. So it's easy to see why 6 years later, Vladimir Putin thought, okay, if I could do this in Georgia, I could do this to Ukraine, because Ukraine is the glittering prize. This is what I want. It started with Crimea, parts of the eastern Donbass region. And yet again, all he got in response was a rap on the knuckles, a slap on the hand, nothing more. Meanwhile, Ukraine continued to exist as a sovereign, independent state with ambitions of becoming a fully-fledged, flourishing democracy with strong ties to the West. This is something that Vladimir Putin could not tolerate. That's why the gloves were off, the masks were off in 2022 when he launched the full-scale invasion.
So going back to the period just before the full-scale invasion, it's clear that Russian troops are on the border. The West takes alarm. Do you recall what they actually did to try and dissuade Putin?
There were phone calls. There were visits. All Western leaders were, or Western officials were told, was basically a collection of cliches. In the run-up to 2022, I remember very well this feeling of, surely he's not going to do it. It's crazy. It's mad. It's so catastrophically wrong. I remember a lot of voices saying, this is just for show. Vladimir Putin is only about money, enrichment. This is a distraction. Well, as we found out, attacking neighbours, expanding what's left of the Russian so-called sphere of influence, it seems to be his main overriding objective.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about the challenges facing the NHS and the one about, can Elon Musk found a colony on Mars? Sorry, actually, we haven't done that one yet.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Back to Vladimir Putin. After more than 3 years of war in Ukraine, what has he learned? What does he hope for? And what will he settle for? I'm joined by Laurie Bristow, the president of Hughes Hall at Cambridge University and the former UK ambassador to Russia from 2016 to 2020. Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in the US and a former national intelligence officer for Russia. And Mark Galliotti, writer on Russian security affairs and director of the consultancy Mayak Intelligence. Angela Stent, can I ask you first, if you cast your mind back to 2022, the Americans had intelligence that Putin would invade. Why didn't people believe them?
Because people thought that Vladimir Putin was not a major risk taker. They thought he was pragmatic. He was determined to subdue Ukraine. But they believed that what he would probably do would be to try and fully occupy the Donbas region, the two regions there. They didn't think of him as reckless. And given what the U.S. intelligence officials were seeing, they believed that a full-scale invasion would be reckless, and they doubted that Russia would win.
Mark, was that how you saw it?
Yes, look, I'll be honest. Until about a week or so before the actual invasion, I didn't believe it. Precisely as Angela said, because Putin's track record was that he was not a risk taker for all his macho postures. The problem was, of course, that what seemed common sense to me was not common sense to Putin. As far as he was concerned, as far as he was being told by the people around him, who, you know, essentially act as an echo chamber, Ukraine was this non-country, was in disarray, that there were all sorts of Ukrainians who'd be willing to support a Russian-backed candidate, and that the rest of Ukrainians, most of them, wouldn't resist. So from his point of view, this wasn't a risk, that Ukraine was there to be plucked.
Laurie Bristow, you'd been ambassador in Moscow up until, about 18 months to 2 years before the actual invasion. How did you see it at the time?
Well, you'll recall also that before the February 2022 invasion, there was a very big build-up of military forces in 21, which looked very worrying at the time, but then they were to some degree built back down again. I think, you know, we're probably all seeing this the same way. The intelligence was telling us that he was planning to invade. The problem we all had was that it didn't make sense. And I think there's a broader question here to go forward to the phase of the war that we're in now about how governments take bad decisions. And I think one of the themes that, you know, we really should be exploring is, how is it that this gap appears between the world as you'd like it to be and the world as it actually is? That's a problem for Putin as much as for Western policymakers.
Indeed. Angela, did Putin think, do you think, that he could recreate the USSR by taking back Ukraine? Or was his objective more nebulous?
So Putin, I think, is not interested in recreating the USSR, but he's certainly interested in recreating parts of the Russian Empire. I think his immediate aim was clearly to subjugate Ukraine, to put in power a government that was pro-Russian. But I think his ambitions were then and still are now far broader than that.
Laurie Bristow, how have you seen his long-term objective in Ukraine?
Like Angela, I really don't see this as being about trying to recreate the USSR. I think this war is fundamentally about Russia and about the idea of Russia in the mind of Mr. Putin, his generation of securocrats. But in terms of what he does actually want here, I think a lot of this is also about revisiting the consequences of the end of the USSR and the Cold War, and in particular, establishing or re-establishing a Russian sphere of influence in Central and Eastern Europe, but also about rolling back what it sees as American encroachments on Russian interests. So he's pretty clearly trying very hard now to decouple the US from the Europeans and to decouple the US from the Ukrainians in this war. I think he'll push very hard for as much as he can get in terms of military pullback on the American side. But also, I think, and this is a really important point for the Trump administration, he wants to cut the Americans down to size. And I think there should be really no misunderstanding of that in Washington.
In other words, he wants them out of Europe.
He wants them out of Europe, but also he wants to establish that there are really three great powers in the world and that they're more or less equal. Those great powers are the US, Russia and China. And that if the United States, any US administration thinks that it can trample over Russia's interests as Putin sees them, they've got another thing coming.
Mark, what do you think made Putin believe that February 2022 was the time to launch this big invasion? After all, we'd had a kind of stasis following 2014.
Yes, and certainly if Putin was this mastermind of four-dimensional geopolitical chess that we're sometimes told, logic would have sort of suggested that he potentially continue his previous campaign, because this massive troop buildup on the Ukrainian border was not just about intimidating Ukraine. It was also actually about intimidating potential investors. And we had seen that a lot of investors were actually fleeing the Ukrainian market. The Ukrainian economy was in crisis. So patience would have served him probably well. However, I think there's a combination of, look, on one level, just simply a sort of a human impatience that crept into Putin himself. You know, ultimately, we are talking about a decision which one man gets to decide. And I think he just basically felt, OK, I've given this the best part of a year. The Ukrainians haven't capitulated yet. Given that there's no reason not to, why not roll in?
Angela, what do you think about his timing?
I think you have to look at the international context. He looked at the United States and the catastrophe with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. He thought the Biden administration was weak and that wouldn't respond. He looked at Europe. France, I think, was in an election campaign. The Germans were trying to form a new government. So he thought that the Europeans were distracted and also that they had a strong interest in maintaining their economic relationship with Russia, particularly the Germans importing Russian gas. He also believed that the Ukrainian army was much weaker than it was. And I would just add here that Sergei Viseda, the FSB agent official who told him that in fact the Ukrainians would welcome him and that the army wasn't strong, is now the person negotiating with the Trump team. He's just been in Riyadh. But put that aside for a moment. So I think he
Well, maybe he could give them some advice.
Maybe. And then I think he believed that the Russian army was much more competent, stronger than it turned out to be because of all of the corruption.
Laurie, one of the reasons why we thought it was reckless what Putin was doing was because we knew that the West was bound to respond. How do you explain his miscalculation about that?
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree that the West was bound to respond. What happened in Afghanistan was read by Putin as an almost abject lack of will to stand up for our own interests. And I was there at the time. I was the UK ambassador in Kabul at the time of the fall. And it was pretty humiliating, frankly, for the US and its allies.
Let's talk about what he has learned on the battlefields of Ukraine, Angela.
I think he learned an unwelcome lesson at the beginning, which was A, that the Russian army was less competent than he thought he was, and B, that the Ukrainians were determined to fight back, and C, that obviously the United States and its European allies were giving Ukraine an enormous amount of assistance. But I think he's also learned, as time has gone on, that there's a limit to how much the Ukrainians can push back, just partly because of the shortage of people to fight, and also because of disagreements among the Western alliance about how far to go in supporting Ukraine. And I think by now he's learned in the last 2 months that with the new American administration, his goal of sort of separating Europe from the United States, that has been enormously assisted by the Trump administration coming in and itself separating itself from Europe. So I think he's learned a series of lessons now. And that's why I believe that he's in no hurry to end this war.
Mark, can we just talk for a moment about the actual objective effect of the war on Russia in terms of people, in terms of losses, in terms of economic cost?
In terms of the people lost, obviously, we have our estimates. The most recent American estimate I've seen is 750,000 wounded or dead, whereas the British Ministry of Defence puts it higher at 900,000 wounded or dead, of whom maybe 200,000 to 250,000 are actually dead, which is, of course, a terrible toll. But in some ways, it's not just that. It's that this is also going to be a sort of a major toll when the war ends, when the veterans go back. There's an average of 30 to 35% have probably got some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Most Russians, they don't know the casualty numbers. And so they have a very incomplete picture of what's happening. And then we also know that when there are casualties and when people do come home in body bags, Putin now, they give significant sums of money to the family to compensate them for that. And they tell them, you know, your son died a hero.
Laurie Bristow, now you're ambassador in Moscow, as we said, till 2020. Did you have the feeling then that public opinion counted for something with Vladimir Putin?
Public opinion certainly counted for something up until about 2020, 2021. You know, really until the onset of the full-scale invasion, there were institutions in Russia, for example, Echo of Moscow, the radio station, and organizations like Memorial, an NGO set up to unearth the crimes against the Russian and Soviet people of the Soviet state and more latterly the Russian state. They existed. They played a role in helping to keep the system to some degree accountable. They were all closed down within days. of the full-scale invasion. So I think what we've now got is a system, it's under economic pressure. There are clearly demographic pressures, which were there to start with, but the war is exacerbating them dramatically. It's a low birth rate country. And also, you know, the military is under pressure. It hasn't performed well. They've lost a lot of kit. But it's a system with essentially no accountability. So the idea that, you know, Mr. Putin will be forced to compromise from within, either by an uprising on the street or by a palace coup, I just don't buy that.
Angela, as far as we can tell, bearing in mind what Laurie has said, what do we know about what Russians think about the war now?
Well, again, it's very hard to gauge public opinion in Russia because it's such a repressive system. People have to be very careful about what they tell pollsters, even the only remaining independent one, the Levada. So according to Levada, a majority of the Russians still support the war. They support Putin, but they also support negotiations with one proviso that Russia doesn't give anything up. There's, I think, 20% of the people who do oppose the war. But I think you have to remember that 1 million Russians have left Russia since the war began.
I want to turn to the economy now discreetly. We talked about it on this programme last November. And back then, the view was, yep, it's in trouble. Inflation is racking up. That will have a long-term effect, actually a medium-term effect, but it's not in danger of imminent collapse. Can we update that a bit and dig into it, Mark Galeotti?
I mean, in a way, the answer is not really, because it's the same situation. But there are continuing increasing pressures. But I think what we have to understand is they are not going to suddenly force the collapse or the implosion of the Russian economy. We are seeing Russia sliding towards a situation of stagflation. So in other words, stagnation combining with inflation, which is, again, a terrible thing in the long term. But this is an authoritarian regime. It can and will divert resources where it needs to in order to maintain its policy objectives, which in this case are fighting the war. It's likely that in 2026, we are going to see some much, much tougher guns versus butter type questions having to be answered. Because up to now, Putin has been trying to ensure that the impact on ordinary Russians is minimized. Well, that's going to get harder and harder. But again, when it comes down to it, it's not going to happen dramatically. Quickly. It's going to be a slow degradation of quality of life. Sanctions are absolutely working in the sense of they were never really intended to sort of crash the system, but rather to impose costs. But we're pretty much at a point where it's hard to see what more sanctions could actually do to Russia that wouldn't also have a major impact on us as well.
Laurie Bristow, what do you think?
The Russian economy isn't going to collapse anytime soon. This is, I think, for the Russian state, a longer term problem rather than an immediate problem. It's a very serious problem over time. But in the short term, Mr. Putin can generate the resources he needs to keep his war going. They are under pressure, though, which is why there's a very clear line coming out in their negotiations with the Americans. There are things that they want. They want sanctions lift. They want easing of sanctions. The possible deal around the Black Sea is important to Russia in a number of ways, but one of those ways is the leverage they hope it gives them to reopen Russian grain exports to world markets and to ease sanctions on the banks that deal with the payments for that.
I think that brings me to, has Vladimir Putin's position moved at all in terms of what his bottom line actually is, what he would be prepared to accept for ending his invasion? Angela, what do you think?
I don't think it's moved much at all. I think Russia's demands remain the same, that Ukraine accepts the permanent incorporation of the four annexed territories, none of which Russia fully controls, into Russia, and that Crimea is gone forever, that it agree to be permanently neutral, that it will never join NATO. Maybe the Russians would allow it to join the European Union, but that's also problematic because the EU would have to do reform itself in order really to admit Ukraine. And then the demilitarization of Ukraine, if not the total demilitarization of Ukraine, than a substantial amount of it. And of course, elections in Ukraine, which they can't hold now under martial law. But what the Russians want still is regime change, someone else coming to power in Kiev. I don't see any of these goals having changed.
Mark Galeotti, let's imagine that there's a bottom line for Putin. There's an irreducible point below which he will not accept. What would we understand that bottom line to be?
His bottom line is regime survival. And you know, his position or whatever. So, I mean, I think there are some things that he has already identified as being impossible to step back from. Crimea was one, and I think increasingly, essentially, the occupied territories. I don't think there's any sense that the Russians are going to be willing to withdraw troops from anything more than the most marginal territories. Remember that Putin is more than anything else an opportunist rather than a strategist. And so I think what we are talking about is a situation in which essentially what Putin is after is the most he can get away with.
Laurie, could he ever accept a Ukraine that is a member of NATO? Could he accept that he gets no more than the regions that Russia presently occupies? And could he accept that there would be a government in Ukraine that might not be friendly to Russia? Because, after all, why would it be?
I can't see that his underlying objectives, his fundamental objectives, have changed in the slightest, and I don't think they will unless something really fundamental changes here. I think he's looking to win, not to compromise, and I think he is winning. And I think he thinks he's winning partly because he's got major concessions from the Trump administration up front in exchange for no concessions on his side. So in terms of what happens next, I think it's possible we'll get to some kind of ceasefire. But, you know, we need to be really clear that a ceasefire with Mr. Putin does not mean the ceasing of fire. It's the beginning of the next stage in the underlying conflict. And to come to bottom lines, I think we need to be really clear in the UK, the US, the West more generally, what our bottom line here is. And I think that's all about the consequences of what happens in Ukraine for our own security.
Angela, is there any world in which Putin's bottom line is acceptable to Ukraine?
I don't believe there is. The issue is what role Europe can play in this going forward, because clearly Europe at the moment takes a very different view of what Mr. Putin should or shouldn't receive from these negotiations with the US.
Mark, let's say a comprehensive ceasefire, short of a full peace, is agreed with Russia, and everybody breathes a sigh of relief and says, well, that's that then. Can Putin be trusted to adhere to the terms of any such ceasefire? And what does history suggest to us about this?
Look, of course, Putin is not a good faith actor. If trust is what we're putting our faith in, then everyone is in trouble. It is about ensuring that if there is some kind of deal to be struck, and I'm a little bit more optimistic, I think, than everyone else on the panel, that it is possible, not necessarily likely. But nonetheless, there has to be that very clear sense of, if you are contemplating simply using this, for example, as a breathing space before launching your next round against Ukraine, then you will have even more serious consequences. And these are both credible and specifically laid out terms.
Angela, what do you think about that?
I think that's possible. But then we come back to the question of how is Ukraine going to get the sufficient guarantees to deter Russia? And we're now in a situation where Europe has woken up more and realizes that there have to be robust security guarantees for Ukraine. Obviously, the best guarantee would be Ukrainian membership of NATO, but that's been taken off the table. But if you don't have a Trump administration that's willing to back up security guarantees like this, it's very hard for me to believe that we could deter Putin going forward, because the situation wouldn't be that different as it was before February 2022.
Laurie, what seems to be being said here is the kinds of security guarantees that would actually guarantee Ukraine's sovereign future are the kinds of security guarantees that Vladimir Putin could never accept. Is that right?
I think that's exactly the point. And if I were advising the US negotiators today, my advice would be this: put out of your minds that there is a quick deal to be done that ends this conflict. There isn't, because of the nature of the conflict, what brought it into being. The question for all of us is, how are we going to deal with a Russia that is pretty much like the one we've got now for the foreseeable future? So whatever happens over a ceasefire, we're still going to be dealing with a Mr. Putin in the Kremlin, with a Russia that whose fundamental objectives have not changed. They will not change while Mr. Putin is in power. Russia will not change while Mr. Putin is in power. And even after he leaves power, which may be some years from now, we may still not be in a situation where, you know, Russia is looking for a fundamentally different relationship with the West. So we need to think long term, and we need to think about how to deter Russian aggression in the long term.
And if the American administration thinks otherwise, it's deluded.
I think they're making a very, very serious mistake if they think that there is a deal to be had that will resolve this conflict.
And that's all we have time for. My thanks to Laurie Bristow, Angela Stent and Mark Galeotti. And my conclusion from all that, not an optimistic one. What Putin wants, Ukraine cannot give. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Beth Ashmead-Latham, Kirsty Knight and Caroline Bailey. The sound engineers were Rod Farker and Neil Churchill. The editor is Richard Barden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
From BBC Radio 4.
They remind me of the beauty of the everyday.
Illuminated is the home for creative, one-of-a-kind documentaries that shed light on hidden worlds.
You could hear the plants photosynthesizing.
A place of audio beauty and joy, with emotion and human experience at its very heart.
You can see the people walking, bewildered, absolutely bewildered. Nobody really knew what to think.
The programmes you'll find here explore the reality of contemporary Britain and the world. It's a chance to meet voices that are not normally heard.
You don't open your mouth. If you tell one person, that's it.
Illuminated, from BBC Radio 4. All human life is here, just waiting to be discovered. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.